shaking her fist, and an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Conservative Voice here on WWDB 860 AM. I'm Don Beisel, Jr., and I'm joined remotely by my good friend and co-host, Gary Heasley. Gary? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's a
good afternoon, John.
It's a somber day here in the Southeast as we got our butts kicked on Tuesday. But hey, you know, you've got to keep going forward. I mean, that's all there is to it, you know? I mean, that's the bottom line. So, I mean, it's a shame.
Yes, it is.
But this is what you reap when you, I don't know, what's a nice way of saying putting up candidates that don't stand for anything? I don't know what else to say. But.
Right, yeah. The feckless candidate has a hard time winning. And in this case, in this particular cycle, there were a lot of candidates who were pretty strong.
Right. It's the lack of a coherent message. You and I have talked about this before, that, you know, when you just think that for some reason that mail-in ballots is the tonic that's going to cure the illness, I say putting a mail-in ballot into the hands of an uninformed voter, when you do it with no message, is like putting the loaded gun into the hands of a five-year-old. And you never know what's going to happen. So you have to have a strong, coherent message when you give a zero or a one a mail-in ballot. You know, you have to give them a reason why they're going to fill that mail-in ballot out and a reason why they're going to vote for you. If you just hand them the ballot and then some Democratic operative knocks on the door and says to them, hey, vote for me because I'm going to erase all your student debt, you've just put ammunition into the hands of somebody that's an uninformed voter, and they're going to say, heck, if they're going to forgive my $100,000 student debt, I'm going to vote for them. I'm not going to vote for that Republican guy, even though I'm a registered Republican. So, unfortunately, what we have here is the GOP establishment always is a day late and a dollar short in their ideas and their thinkings that they can just, you know, ride the coattails of what the Democrats started with mail-in ballots. I mean, there has to be a coherent and strong message along with the advancing of mail-in ballots to the Republican base. I mean, we've talked about that many times. I want to bring in our guest, as we have every week, Senator Doug Mastriano. Senator, welcome to the show. Senator?
Hello, I'm here. I'm here.
There you go.
I want to wish the Marines a birthday. Happy birthday to Marines, 1775 Tun Tavern in Philadelphia. They were founded. And tomorrow, Veterans Day. So, veterans, thank you for your service.
Yep, it is Veterans Day weekend. And I think it's very important that we recognize those that have served our country. My question, Senator, is would those veterans recognize the country that they've so served? I mean, would they recognize what we've become?
I mean, I don't even recognize the country that I served in the 80s, you know, during the Cold War, where there was clarity of purpose, where there was the evil empire, the Soviet system, the godless system, the atheist system, and then America standing for freedom and righteousness and hope. And we've lost our way. And that we have these protests across America and Pennsylvania, you know, attacking Israel and threatening the lives of Jews. And we're seeing the anti-Semitism largely coming out of the left. I mean, just unmasked. And the Democrats, five or six of them, you know, outright anti-Semites. And their party felt so easy last year to, of course, attack our campaign. And guess what? The secret was the anti-Semites are largely on their side. And facts are stubborn things.
Right.
We have. And with Israel, I mean, it's a bastion of freedom. It's of hope. Within Israel itself, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, and atheists all coexist together. There's tolerance for all people there. You know, I've been there a couple times, even to the Wailing Wall a bunch of times to pray. I had my prayer answered, too, by the way. And, you know, it's a special place, historically and religiously connected with America. So we have to stand by them.
I agree. I mean, and you know, so when I see these protests, the Free Palestine and so forth and so on, I don't blame the people, but what I blame is that they are grossly misinformed, and they're falling victim to the far left's ability to manipulate them into protesting for something that they probably don't really understand what they're protesting, because I believe that even the people that live in Palestine would love to get rid of Hamas, but instead of standing up to them, they've succumbed to them and they let them stay there. So the real enemy here is not so the civilians of Palestine. It is the terrorist organization Hamas. I mean, I'm going to ask you: is that how you see it? You're probably more in tune with this from your military standpoint than I am. How do you see this situation?
I mean, it's really hard. I mean, so there's 2 million people, you know, in the Gaza Strip. They're Arabs. Arabs didn't really settle in the region until after the conquest by Muhammad's armies. He passed away before they reached the Holy Land. And so, they migrated there as well as North Africa. That was all Christian at one time. But it's really difficult. I mean, we Americans, we desperately want to separate. You know, when we wage war, it's against Saddam Hussein and not the Iraqi people. You know, when these days, there was no distinction in World War II, though. I mean, right. So when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, there was no cause. No one dare tell the United States, show restraint, have a ceasefire, have a pause. You know, instead, the war was vicious on both sides. The Japanese were particularly brutal and genocidal with the Chinese people. For instance, 1 million of the Chinese, the rape of Nanking, of course, is down in infamy, 1937. The slaughter and brutality towards women and children, similar to what we saw from the attack on Israel by Gaza.
Right.
But, you know, America then, it was total war. And that was the lesson of World War I, total war. And America firebombed Tokyo, which killed more people than the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. You know, the Germans began in Europe. Now, this is a complex question, so I'm sorry to go down. So the Germans begin. So first off, the Nazis. The Nazis. Hitler was elected to office by 10% of the German people. The United States in World War II did not say, you know, We're only waging war against the regime. We're going to avoid civilian targets. The Americans, you know, let's bring it home to us and the British, who suffered. The British suffered the Blitz. They were bombed by the Germans. The Germans were the first really to bomb cities, London, in 1940. So the Americans and British launched a strategic bombing campaign. You know, for instance, firebombed Hamburg. It was the first firestorm ever to engulf a city. It was like tornadoes of fire, incinerating people, sucking the air out of their lungs. I mean, it was a horrific, and 45,000 dead. Bombing Dresden, and the conditions have to be right for a firestorm. That happened in Dresden near the end of the war, just weeks away from the end of the war. I mean, it was another catastrophe, horrific for the citizens. In this strategic bombing campaign, I think several hundred thousand, 250,000 German civilians died by the strategic bombing campaign by the British and the Americans, including 75,000 children. So, you know, now fast forward 80 years, and I do not advocate the bombing of civilians. I'm just giving historic context here. Obviously, I was in the Army for 30 years, and we went to great pains in our targeting to avoid civilian casualties. And I don't want to even use the word collateral damage. That's so callous, civilian casualties. Because there are innocents, people like the Hamas, they hide amongst the population. They want civilians to be their shields. It's a very cowardly thing, but it's how they wage war. So how do you separate now in our modern terms where we no longer, you know, just relentlessly bomb cities? Thank God. I mean, that's awful. That's terrible. But so now you're Israel. You have this greatest attack in your history. It's 30 times worse than 9/11 population-wise. So imagine a 9/11 where we lost 30,000 people instead of 3,000 people.
Right.
And how catastrophic that would be to our psyche. And then you have the world now saying, okay, take a pause, take a ceasefire, you know, let's open up a corridor. And the Israelis, you know, God bless them, they've opened up a corridor. Hamas has occasionally killed the citizens using the corridor. We've seen video of citizens condemning the Hamas leadership hiding in their billionaire luxury places in Qatar, you know, down in the Saudi Peninsula. And so it's going to be an awful long war. And I don't know. You know, we need to have endurance. Israel has the right to exist. They were there well before, you know, the Arabs came in. It was their capital 3,000 years ago, Jerusalem, by King David. I mean, just but to see the revision of history. So you're right. You know, people don't know history. They don't often know what they talk about. When we hear a Congresswoman Tlaib say, you know, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. That's calling for the extermination of the Israeli people. You just can't say Jews because it's a multi-ethnic, multi-religion area. It includes people from, you know, all faiths. So they're saying, you know, eliminate the existence of Israel. So what does that mean? Another genocide? I mean, these people are nuts when they're chanting this here because that's it's similar to what the Nazis did. But here's the distinction, and I know I've talked long.
That's okay.
So here's the final thought. You know, in World War II, what the Nazis did was unprecedented, you know, in modern times. It was horrific for a modern society to do that with the butchery and savagery. I stood at the ghetto in 1943. I wasn't there in 43, but I stood where the Jewish uprising in the ghetto in Warsaw happened. You know, I got to remember Mordecai and the other Jewish leaders after losing hundreds of thousands, being starved to death or killed by the Nazis, rising up. I stood on the Umbunksplatz in Warsaw, where 250,000 Jews were boarded trains and sent off to death camps, like Auschwitz, to die. I mean, what happened? But it's interesting, the Nazis tried to cover it up. What the Gazans, what the terrorists did in Gaza, they were celebrating. There's you know, camera images and videos of these people calling mom or walking around with a head bragging to their dad and grandma that, you know, that they killed so many Jews. There's something really different. I mean, we got to be careful with history, but you know, the Nazis were horrific, but in their heart, it's like some knew it was wrong and tried to cover it up. With Gaza, they're proud of it. They want everyone to know that they murdered babies and women and raped people and, you know, tore bodies apart. So what do you do? How do you coexist with the people that want you dead?
Well, so this is one of the things that I think that is important to realize is that if the normal citizens of in Gaza don't want to be connected with these people from Hamas, it's going to be up to them to stand up and expose them. Like I just saw the gentleman from Israel. I think it was Netanyahu. It was I can't remember the gentleman's name, but basically what he was saying was, look, you turn this guy over to us, or give him to us, or tell us where to get him, you know, and we can put an end to this, you know. But so again, the aspect of the citizenry wanting to be safe, well, that is in their hands. It's going to be up to them to reject what Hamas is doing, because what they did was horrific, and Israel has every right to do what they're doing, you know. And for Tlaib to say, you know, that there should be just one Palestine and that's it. I mean, even Netanyahu says, you know, they support the two-state solution, and a lot of the Jewish people support the nobody from the Israeli side is saying let's exterminate Palestine.
That's right.
You know, they're not. This is coming from the other direction, and I think that's what people need to realize. You know, so you know what they did, and I'm glad you brought up the population percentages, because people don't realize when they only said, like, I think it was like the number was like 1,400 or whatever was killed. You know, but if you do that in the percentage of what the population, and you math that out, it does come out to that 30,000 mark that we were talking about, like 3,000 at the World Trade Center. So, you know, everything has to be put into perspective. But, you know, the Israelis have been fighting for survival since they got there. And the United States has always been, I just watched an old interview with Richard Nixon with Ted Koppel, and Nixon was saying that every president in the future, present and future, will be supporting Israel no matter what. Well, I'm starting to question that now. You know, will the Biden administration, even though so far they have milquetoastly, you know, will going forward, will we stand by the only ally we have in the Middle East?
You know, clearly the America Nixon was talking to at the time is not the same America we live in today.
Yes.
And then we have John Kirby, who'd rather, I think, would be better off with his family vacuum company than with the position he's been. He's advocating yesterday for the Israelis to take a pause. They don't want to call it a ceasefire, a pause. And he goes, oh, it's so important. We can get humanitarian aid in. We can help people evacuate. But, he, as a retired admiral, I know he was at sea and not land, but he surely must learn military theory. But also it benefits Hamas. It lets them reorganize, regroup, retrain, re-equip, and get into a position to ambush the Israelis, maybe try another cross-border operation if they get through the Israeli army that's there now. I mean, so it's always this one-sided story. So you're Israel. You've since 1979, you've been working towards a two-state solution. I mean, I say 79 because that's, of course, the peace accords at Camp David. And the Israelis gave up all the Sinai Peninsula, which they were settling, and they evacuated, removed the settlers out of the Sinai Peninsula, gave it back to Egypt for peace. That worked well. Egypt has abided by their promises. And then under a lot of pressure from Clinton and Bush and Obama, the Israelis, you know, have been forced in this two-state solution where they surrendered portions of Samaria, called the West Bank, and all of the Gaza Strip. Dismantling all of their settlers in Gaza. And I wonder now, though, if the two-state solution is dead. I don't see a way forward from here. They might talk it because that's the West mantra. But I don't see, if you're leading Israel, how you could even embrace that idea any longer, that at least a two-state solution with the Gaza Strip operating under their own security since 2005. I think that's not a viable option anymore.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough road to hoe. It really is.
Well, if you've made some really interesting points on that historical discussion you did, Doug. I mean, that was extremely helpful. Coming back to the question of what is it that the average Gazan or West Bank resident wants, I didn't see any sort of pushback around the world against the Hamas attack. I didn't see any. But within, I don't know, 24 hours of the Israelis making any response, there were riots or extraordinarily aggressive protests that rose up globally, all with Palestinian flags, almost as if there's a Palestinian flag depot in every city. I don't know how they got these flags so quickly. I never imagined there were this many Palestinian flags around the world. So the question that I think you touched on is, Don, I think you were touching on it, Is a two-state solution possible if the vast majority of people living in Gaza and Samaria, if they actually do want to exterminate the Jewish population and all of Israel? So, you know, because it's Christians too, right, that would be in there, and it would be we saw some Arabs who had been working with the Israelis who have been beaten or kidnapped. So this really seems to me more like an existential conclusion here. I mean, a conclusion to an existential threat. It seems to me, not having your depth of study in this, Doug, that this is possibly the move by Hamas and its backers at Iran and Hezbollah and, you know, Unit 901 and all these groups to finally put an end to Israel. They see the United States not just as weak but as conflicted, as I see it.
Yeah.
I mean, when you've got somebody like Kirby, and you tell me he was an admiral, and I know he was, that is hard for me as an American citizen to reconcile that guy actually reached the rank of admiral. I can't imagine a military where that's possible. But given that that's the case, we have people like our leadership in the Foreign Service, our leadership in the military, our leadership in the clandestine operations, and our leadership in the political sphere, none of whom seem capable of handling any of this. So we're weak. But at the same time, you've got people like John Kerry who are friends with the mullahs in Iran, who worked with them to try to defeat America during the Trump administration. a group that since Obama's installation have been trying to get the nuclear bomb into the hands of the Iranians. By all evidence of their actions, including the nuclear deal that they touted as a ban, that as everyone looked at it said that's a 10-year path to absolute having this bomb. You know, the $6 billion has been talked about a lot, less so the lack of restrictions that or lifting of restrictions on oil trade that pumped billions of dollars into Iran. So at one point, they claim to be supporting Israel, but they're also supporting the other side. We're literally funding both sides or enabling both sides of this, and we've got people who seem incapable of handling. So you got two issues here. One is, what is the true intent of the average person in the West Bank and in Gaza? Do they have any interest in living in peace alongside Jews, Christians, and others? And then secondarily, what is the role the United States is playing when we seem dazed and confused, wandering around in a very with a lot of power being used in the most dangerous of ways and seemingly supporting both sides? I don't see how this comes out in a way that is sort of this two-state solution where people shake hands and go back to a peaceful coexistence.
So let's surmise. So the Nazis rise to power in the 30s. They're elected to their parliamentary system. They take it, you know, not by storm. They take it by election. And in 1940, so about 7-8 years after the Nazis, you know, really rose to prominence and power in Germany, in 1940, only 10% of the German population were Nazis. So let's surmise that only that means only 10% really supported the policies of the Nazis. I know it's a bit of a stretch because everyone has different views, even though their party affiliation is different. But you had Christian Democrats, you had socialists, but the Nazi Party, only 10%. And so when the war broke out, it was irrelevant to the United States and to Great Britain and all others that 90% of the population didn't necessarily support Nazi policies because they were irrelevant. The security services, the military were controlled by the Nazi Party, and it was irrelevant what they all thought. And, you know, there were attempts on Hitler's life, many attempts, about a dozen or so. You know, of course, the greatest one depicted in the movie, you know, the July 1944 plot, like von Stauffenberg and others. But it was irrelevant. And so, you know, let's say that half of the people in Gaza don't like the bloodshed. You know, we've seen videos of people out there expressing outrage, you know, of how the Hamas leadership is acting in luxury while they're dying. But I think it might be irrelevant what the people think. As long as they're being controlled and led by Hamas, it doesn't matter. Hamas is a tyrannical system, a tyrannical government, and they're going to do what they're going to do. And their goals are very clear. They're unapologetic. They really do mean from the river to the sea. And that means the extermination of the Jewish people and Israel as a nation with all its diversity. And, you know, that includes, you know, small Muslim sects like the Druze Muslims as well. You know, it's interesting. You know, the Israeli army, the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, it's you know, not only Jews, it's Christians and Muslims, and Muslims from not just Sunni and Shia, but also Druze and the, you know, Alawites and Ismailis and what have you, and they're able to coexist there. But you don't coexist in Gaza. There's only a fraction of the Christian population that once was there. I have an acquaintance from Gaza that I met in Bethlehem, and you know, he's one of the few Christians, and he had to leave Gaza. It was too intolerant, you know, so he's close to the Israeli controlled security zone over there in Bethlehem. But so I wonder, to your point, though, does it matter what they think if their leadership wants to kill and eliminate Israel?
You know, it's great that you brought that up, Doug, with the comparison, because we've said this over and over again. You and I have had these discussions, and I've had these discussions with other that we fail to learn from history, and history somehow always, in some form, seems to repeat itself in different, you know, obviously in different forms, and we're seeing this happen now. It's basically the same thing here in Gaza, where, you know, 10-15% of the of the country, you know, falls into the Hamas group, but yet, you know, it, like you said, it doesn't matter what the other 90 or 85% of the people think, because, you know, the force, the military aspect of it is controlled by these evil people, similar to the Nazis in Germany, you know. And so this is history in a way repeating itself, and it's good that we brought up this comparison so people can understand the significance of the fact that, you know, it's almost going to be physically impossible to differentiate between quote-unquote innocent civilians and these evil terrorist people. I mean, that would have been like, you know, the Allies trying to just, you know, take out Hitler and his army but not kill, you know, innocent civilians, you know, where the factories were in the middle of these cities and towns and so forth and so on. War is war. And unfortunately, like you said, you know, we don't want to, you know, obviously, you know, belittle the loss of civilian life because we never want that to happen. But in the end, if they're going to sit there and let it happen, then, you know, they're partially to blame. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but that's the truth.
You know, and the fact of the matter, you know, Afghanistan, we have lots of bad guys on the target list, and we would go to, we would cancel missions, you know, with the capability on site to eliminate a target. And because he would go to a civilian area or near a mosque, you know, there would be times that we can't do it because we don't know who's in that building. We don't want to kill women and children.
Right.
I mean, I am so glad and thankful that we have, you know, an army with such a moral compass and all that. And, you know, and it'll take us months to have another opportunity again to take out that target. But that's how it is. So, you know, I say all that in the context of what I just said here. It's impossible to differentiate now when you have Hamas leadership hiding among the population, putting tunnels and headquarters under hospitals and under mosques because they know the Israelis are hesitant to it or will not attack those facilities. And now that Israel is sweeping through Gaza City, they're showing video evidence that, yes, these tunnels are really underneath here. So Hamas is willing to do this, using innocent women and children as shields. So now you're attacked. What do you do?
Right.
I mean, if this was America, if we had 30,000 dead, that would be more casualties than the bloodiest battle or bloodiest single day in American history. It was the Battle of Antietam, 17 September 1862. You know, that's huge. That's more casualties than Antietam, our bloodiest battle in North America. And fast forward, so that now you have to respond. You're a government. You have to protect your people. Then you have a group that's going to hide underneath hospitals and mosques, and it makes it impossible. I received a briefing from an IDF colonel some years ago, and when they were taking out buildings in Gaza with airstrikes, they would say they would knock on the roof, so that they would either call in and alert if they had a number of so many buildings. You have, you know, 5 minutes to get out of that building and all the neighbors go. If they couldn't do that, okay. Or if they did that, still before they take the building down, the Israelis would send a small missile to knock on the roof. So they have a small explosion to take, blow up something on the roof as a final warning before they take down the entire building. I mean, what army does that?
Right. Well, you know, it's almost, I don't know how to say, I'm going to try to say this in the correct way. It's almost like they use our own morality as a weapon against us.
Yeah.
Does that sound, I mean, am I saying that in a correct manner there? Yeah, you know?
Exactly true. I mean, fighting the Taliban was very frustrating, you know, on my tours to Afghanistan because they would hide, just similar to Hamas, they would hide amongst the populace. They would hide by mosques. They would, you know, seek shelter in mosques, sleep in mosques, and, you know, or by hospitals or in an apartment complex. And they knew that we'd be hesitant and reluctant to take them out, you know, knowing that we didn't want to bring civilian casualties. To make matters worse, though, when something would go wrong either on our side or one of their suicide vests would blow up and kill a lot of people, they'd blame it on us. They would lie. The media would run with that message, like we're seeing with Israel and the hospital strike where, you know, an Islamic Jihad missile blew up the hospital and killed lots of people, blamed on Israel, come to find out, oops, it was them. The media would perpetuate the lie. NATO, I was part of NATO, we would do an investigation taking us about 2-3 weeks, find the truth, put the truth out there. By then, nobody cared. Nobody would report the story, and the message had got out. The Taliban propaganda would go out like the Hamas propaganda is being perpetuated by mainstream media.
So
There was one situation like that in, I believe, Iraq. I don't think it was Afghanistan, where Doctors Without Borders was operating a basic sort of hospital unit, and the Al-Qaeda types, I think it was actually Al-Qaeda, but I'm not certain, had established a command center, a weapons depot in that hospital. Doctors Without Borders, MSF, they knew that, and they continued to operate the hospital, everyone being quite certain that the U.S. troops would take no action. Eventually, U.S. troops did take action, took out the group there, and it was immediately reported as the United States attacks a hospital. It just simply wasn't true. That story got out that it was, in fact, a military operation that was in that building, but that story was heard by a small fraction of the people that heard that the United States had just attacked a Doctors Without Borders hospital. And again, Doctors Without Borders knew that was happening. They operated knowing that they were providing cover, being a shield for a military operation.
And how common that is. I mean, in Iraq, we know the baby milk factory story, for Desert Storm back 34 years ago. I'm wearing my retro Operation of Storm Better shirt now. We saw that by Talil Airfield by Nasiriyah on the Euphrates River is the ancient village of Ur, where Abraham is from. And the ziggurat is there. Part of the royal palace that Nebuchadnezzar built is there. I mean, it's a fascinating, beautiful place. But during the air and ground campaign, the Iraqis were hiding their aircraft around these archaeological sites, hoping we wouldn't take them out. But, they didn't realize that we had, precision-guided missiles. So we did, the United States Air Force did take them out. But they'll go to great lengths, putting the history at risk, putting people at risk, whatever it takes to create civilian casualties or damage to sites so that they have a information warfare advantage against us.
So, though I'm sure we could probably talk about this for hours, I want to change gears a little bit and talk about the statewide debacle on Tuesday with the election. I mean, now, but before I do that, I do want to say we did have some significant victories. In Franklin County, Ian Brink won for DA, Dean Horst won. Here in the Southeast, the Satterton School District, they kept all five of their seats, but we had some significant losses. We lost statewide. The Republican Party in Philadelphia is officially now dead and buried. The Working Families Party now took both seats, so the Republican Party is down to Bernie O'Neill as their representative. That's it. And that's a product of appeasement, living off the table scraps, whatever, taking whatever the Democrats wanted to give us. So, Senator, one of the things that I know that, in your campaign when you were running, the ugly head of the establishment reared its head and supported Josh Shapiro, Jim Greenwood, Jeff Bartos, Val DiGiorgio, as just an example. Many county chairs either did nothing or openly, like the former Delaware County chair, openly supported Josh Shapiro. But instead of crawling into a corner and sulking, you've decided to help conservative candidates go forward. So let's do a little introspective of first what you saw that happened on Tuesday and then going forward.
Our party is at war with itself. We have the establishment, which has the advantages of many of the media outlets, the mainstream media like Fox and Hannity personifying that, perpetuating this myth and lie, blaming our losses on the abortion issue. I think it's part of it, but I think mostly it's an establishment issue. The establishment, they want milquetoast, lukewarm candidates like Oz. And, it's ironic. They had their dream candidate and is super moderate and wishy-washy and noncommittal on all the issues that matter to us. And still, he couldn't even be the vegetable. So they want to blame that on me. Are you kidding me? I mean, we had Hannity hop on the radio and blame the results on Tuesday on me again. It's like, so obviously, my name wasn't on the ballot anywhere. And so obviously the establishment wants to demonize the same base they need to win elections. They want to demonize and castigate and push us out so we have no voice, so they can get their McCains, their Romneys, their Ozzes, to lose even more, magnificently than we do otherwise. And so first off, the party needs to stop waging war on itself. The county chairs need to embrace people you know, even if they disagree with them, instead of, you know, doing purges, as has happened in about a half a dozen counties in Pennsylvania. And the party needs to be, you know, be a big tent party. It's okay that we disagree. But when the candidate wins, whether moderate or conservative, everybody needs to get on board. We can't have the former chair of the state party participating in fundraisers for Josh Shapiro, the Democrat. I mean, anyone who's elected as the leader of our state party should be the most dedicated Republican in the state. They should be zealous for the party. And instead, we see, you know, people like Val DiGiorgio and Jeff Bartos, you know, the perennial candidate that's always on the ballot, at least recent history, every couple of years, you know, running off and supporting the Democrat opponent or hosting fundraisers in our house. I mean, you know, saying, oh, it was my wife's thing. Get out. Stop. Just stop. And that they see that that's a problem, that they can't see. I bet you we'll see Bartos on a run in the future and, you know, thinking that we're stupid and forget. That they don't think that this is the end of their political careers and the end of any viability in the Republican Party. But they don't see it that way because they have money and they have connections and the establishment likes them. And so they believe they can, you know, get away with this here. But no, so conservatives, yeah, we have a lot of challenges. And it's tough to win races in Pennsylvania, even if we had unity, which we don't have. And so now is not the time to cower. If you love your country just a tiny bit, continue to vote, continue to be active, and you know, don't like, oh, forget it, my vote doesn't count, you know, I'm going to go to the corner here and color, leave me alone. You know, this is no time to grow weary, because without the help of the establishment, you set a record. It's the greatest turnout for a Republican gubernatorial candidate without all the money, without all the help from Ron and McDaniel, who needs to resign in shame, without help from the RGA, which told this colonel to F off, using the word on me twice, the leader of the Republican Governors Association, when I was pushing them to make a decision, and they had promised help. Without all that help, we still had the greatest turnout in 60 years. So now is the time to redouble our efforts, because I think if we stay the course, if we stay dedicated, if we stay involved, that we'll see this party transform. The state is trending Republican, so now is not the time to grow weary. I'm going to become an independent or a libertarian. Why would you do that when we're so close to actually having a greater voice in the state party than we ever had?
Well, the one takeaway I had was that this Tuesday was a direct result of what they did in your election, and what I mean by that is that this was the base, the conservatives saying, you didn't come out for us, we're not coming out for you. And I think because they put up candidates that a lot of people were not happy with, you know, they endorsed people, you know, they pushed other people out of the process by their endorsements and so forth and so on. And then on top of that, before the election, they did this sham of an endorsement thing at state committee where they endorsed Dave McCormick before they even had this election, which basically shuts out any challengers, and that's what the goal was there. I think in the end, in this election, the conservative base said, you know what? All these years we held our nose for you, and when it was your turn to hold your nose for us because our guy kicked your guy's butts by over a 2-1 margin and you didn't do it, well, guess what? This is what happens if you don't have our support. That's what I think happened.
I agree. I mean, to think that there's going to be no consequences after, you know, you sabotage. Some establishment people got on board in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
I'm not going to throw their names. But some who actively and aggressively worked hard against me in the primary, when I won, they did what we always do, and they got on board and helped fundraisers and tried to get us across the line. So I'm great. So I don't want to say everybody in the mainstream did that, but you know, if you're going to burn the base is not going to come out. And I agree. You know, what kind of terrible idea was that they're going to do an endorsement off cycle? You know, in a year that's not even where he's running for McCormick. Did you not learn anything, Republican Party? And they're going to, you know, do this endorsement, you know, early on, to shut the field down and it leaves a bad taste in a lot of people's mind. It's like, are you rigging elections again? You don't want the people's voices. You don't trust us because you don't like who the people vote for. I mean, it's going to be a hard haul because, you know, McCormick could not even beat Oz. You know, Oz beat him by 800 and some votes here. And then, you know, and Oz was not a good candidate. And he had the money to get a message out still, though. But, you know, aside from that, it's going to be a difficult road. And if you're going to alienate and tick off the base already before his year is even here, 2024 is the year, I don't see a way forward. And so the party needs to be the voice of the people once again, instead of playing these insider games.
So Gary, I know you're chomping at the bit here.
Yeah. What you raise a really important point that we talked about amongst, you know, like the people we're talking about when this McCormick announcement came out, that they endorsed him just before the November election. There was no reason to do it then. They did it in a way that sucked up all the oxygen in the room, so to speak, right? All the media was then focused not on 2023, not on these great candidates we had. It was focused exclusively then for a period of time on McCormick. And that was right in the middle of the period of time where the candidates and the various county committees and state committees should have been focused entirely on engaging the population. They took the eye off that ball. They're so excited at the prospect that McCormick will bring in huge sums of money, which is all they value, that they were willing to sacrifice hours and hours of attention and effort that would have been directed at 23 and refocus it on 24. And of course, at the same time, corporate media was keeping everybody focused on 24 as well. And I think that definitely had an impact on enthusiasm. It had an impact on turnout. And I don't think that was the only factor, but I think that doing that at that time was crazy. And as the Republican Party continues to damage its brand, that was, to your point, a way that they damage the brand that they don't perceive, they don't understand, and they don't care. Because people who want to have a voice in a primary were told just before this election that we're basically canceling the primary for the Senate race in Pennsylvania. 12 main people in Pennsylvania, and the guy they found to run is extremely wealthy, well-connected globally, and comes from Connecticut. You know, it was a very, very bad tactical move, and the timing couldn't have been worse. And so I think you're right. I think that was an impact, not the only one. If you look in the House yesterday or this week, how the Republicans defeated Massey in his effort to kill the kill switch, which we could talk about later, maybe in more detail. But, you know, this is an egregious breach of the Constitution as this kill switch requirement is written. As it will be enacted and how it will be interpreted, it will eventually lead to every vehicle being able to be surveilled to the finest level of detail and turned off if someone in some government office doesn't like what you're doing. So this kill switch requirement that came into the fake infrastructure bill, and I say the fake infrastructure bill because while it was $1.9 trillion, only about, say, roughly 3-5% was actually going to be invested in what is traditionally considered infrastructure. It wasn't about infrastructure. It was about pumping inflationary money into the economy and expanding government power. This kill switch slipped in there. And again, this is a regulation passed by Congress that says, and signed by this guy acting as president, says that every vehicle in 26 has to have a switch in it that will kill the car, shut it off, if the driver is behaving in a way that is considered impaired. No definition of what impaired means. All open to interpretation, and we know, again, how that will be extended out as technology gets implemented. It will be a surveillance and an ability to have your car turned off so you can't move around. So Massey goes after this, takes a big fight. The Republicans stand up in significant numbers to ensure he's defeated. I don't think there's any perception in the Republican Party establishment, what I call the Republicrats, right? They're ideologically no different than Democrats. They're established and have great control over the donor base or are controlled by the donor base. They don't have any idea what we're talking about, and they don't care. They just don't think the peasantry has a voice, should have a voice, or ever will have a voice, and they would much rather lose more elections if it means consolidating power over the party. That's how I see it. I think this path that this party is on will lead to a complete transformation of what it means as a party, what it stands for as a party, which is basically nothing collectively. And I think that they're banking on the fact that they can run the Republican Party as simply a branded team, sort of like a football team that never stands for anything, just puts out nonsensical press releases over fake victories, like, you know, hearings they have in Congress where they say tough things that get on Fox News, but don't actually do anything. The Trey Gowdy model, right? Remember those hearings? Ask tough questions. Never did a single thing to change anything. Pounded tables, acted all tough, spoke with excellent prosecutorial language. All of it a farce. All of it just political theater.
I agree. And, you know, and to your initial point there, which I thought was absolutely spot on, you know, why would you draw the attention away from these four judges that are going around the state and working their tails off and you know, and then come out with the endorsement of McCormick? And you're right, it stole the spotlight from them. It took the attention away, the importance of the judicial races. And then, you know, I guess the party realized that, you know, it was doing that. So then they announced this big scheme in October that McCormick's going to campaign with a judicial candidate. So the four candidates cleared their calendars as best they could. And we're, you know, lugging around the state with him, and it didn't do any good, because you're right, the media was shifted already to 2024. They didn't want the attention on our candidates. They have the advantage with the media already being biased towards the Democrat candidates. And as a result of this ridiculous, ill-advised decision, because we're always told to wait till after the election cycle so we don't draw attention away from the immediate election coming up,
right?
Except this time, for some strange reason. And we turn around and we had this huge defeat all around us here, which means we don't have a chance of getting a Republican majority again in the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania until 10 years from now.
Right. Well, first of all, let's be real clear. The love affair with Dave McCormick is based on dollar signs. Let's be completely honest here. I mean, this is what it's about. You know, they want his money. Okay. Who cares if he has business ties to the Chinese government? Okay. Those questions have still not been answered. Okay.
You're right, but when you say that it's about money, and it certainly is, but it is in fact the case that it's those business ties that they believe will bring additional cash flow that they want.
Mm-hmm.
These people are not ideologically aligned with what people, you know, sort of think Republican values are. They're aligned with the need to generate cash flow.
I want you to continue your point, but I just want to say this. Could you imagine Senator Mastriano in 1980 if Ronald Reagan had business ties to the Soviet Union and he was running for president? I mean, just let's put it in perspective here, okay? Let's go back to history and say, I'm Ronald Reagan, I'm running for president, but I have millions of dollars invested in the USSR because, you know, I'm a businessman too, you know. So just think about that for a second. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, you know, you're right, but you look at there was a president appointed who had houses he couldn't afford, and everyone knew it. They knew how he got those houses. They knew about his ties to the CCP. They knew about Rosemont Seneca. They knew about Moscow's mayor. They knew about Burisma. None of that mattered, not to the media, not to the parties, not to the Republican Party, who did nothing to take advantage of that. And so when you roll forward from that to now, where they're saying, okay, this is a guy who's eloquent, excellent candidate, great experience, very sharp, smart guy who can bring us cash from whatever sources, and we don't care what they are because the party's basically bankrupt, right? The party's donations are at an all-time low, I suspect. I haven't done the math on that, but they can't be robust. The county committees are in deep financial trouble, and so he represents cash. I don't think those people, the Republicrats, those that are ideologically aligned with Democrats but wear a Republican brand, I don't think those people care where the money comes from. I don't think they care about anything except the money. And I, you know, if I'm wrong, I'd be happily proven wrong, because it would be a great relief to find out that they actually cared about and would fight for something. And let me be clear, too. I cast a wide brush when I say that, but it is crystal clear that within the Republican Party, especially within the Pennsylvania House and Senate, there are absolute patriots who are willing to fight, who lean into the fight, and who fight on behalf of the American people. They're minority, but they're loud and they're courageous. And these people are the folks that the Republican electorate has to get behind and support. because if they walk in by themselves into the legislature, well, then it's 1, 2, 10, maybe 22 legislators, right?
Right.
But if they walk in at the head of a column of voters and civilians who are standing up with them and supporting their policies and amplifying their message, then they become an army, a real force in the politic of Pennsylvania. I think there's a role for the citizens to play here, but this leadership that is simply focused on cash will destroy this party in their quest for money.
Well, the thing is, and you know, obviously, you know, Senator Mastriano leads his group in the Senate of the conservatives, and in the House we have the Freedom Caucus. You know, Stephanie Barowitz. We had on Representative Tom Jones last week. But we need more of them because when I talked about this last night at Rachel Moyer's announcement that she's running against Russ Diamond in the 102nd district here in Pennsylvania. I talked about this last night that, you know, people need to remember we had 16 Republicans and most and a majority. I think, Senator, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, it was the entire leadership in this House that voted for a Democrat leader, which cost us voter ID. And so, you know, we need to understand what happened in January of this year.
And Don, we have to also understand that it's not unique to Pennsylvania. The same operation occurred in Ohio at the same moment in time.
Yeah. So, I mean, Senator, I mean, I know you're in touch with a lot of your fellow patriots. I mean, we're taking the steps that are necessary, but it's going to be a process. We didn't get here overnight, and we're not going to correct this overnight, but gosh forbid, folks, we cannot give up. And I think, Senator, that's the message that you've been given all along is don't stop.
Yep. Yeah, we have to stay the course. And, you know, with this movement we have, now we have to grow the movement. We have to show endurance and dedication.
Right. And it can't – the success of the conservative movement cannot be based solely on wins and losses. I can't stress this enough, is that – If you base what you stand for based solely on the fact that you won, then you've already lost. Because you especially like say for and I'm just God, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but even in the city of Philadelphia, if we're going to ever take that back, which could take another 60 years, okay, you can't have people running unopposed constantly. Somebody's got to go in there. Like Aaron Beshear, he's run three times. He's got a bloody nose three times, but he still keeps going because he understands the importance of getting another message out there. Okay, and so not only is it important that we hold the line like we did in Franklin County with Ian Brink and Dean Horst, and in Montgomery County at the Satterton School District level where they won all five of the school seats. But we also have to go in and try to change the hearts and minds, you know, and have, you know, good candidates like we had with Tom DiBello and Liz Ferry in Montgomery County. And even though they lost, they still went out there and put the message out there, like Aaron Beshear in Philadelphia, that even though he lost, he put the message out there. He never wavered from supporting Senator Mastriano. He never wavered from supporting President Trump in the city of Philadelphia. So you can't moderate your message for the sake of a win or a loss. You have to stay true to who you are and what you believe in. I'm just going to say this out front. It's one of the things I admire about you, Senator, is that through all the slings and arrows and the pressure to moderate your message and, you know, soften your stance on abortion and soften this and do that, you stayed the course. And that's what we need.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know, Don, I agree with everything you say, but it bears repeating for anyone who is now sitting at this and saying, this is the third cycle in a row where we've had inexplicable losses.
Mm-hmm.
Inexplicable.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into some of the stuff in a little later maybe. But as a citizen, we have to think about this awesome responsibility we have. I had a discussion with a leftist the other day. And I was explaining to him that every vote he'd cast in his entire life led us to the 10 million border invasion, the child trafficking being ramped up to an industrial level industry, that it's, you know, $9 billion industry in the United States, an industrial level activity. It's his fault. And I mean that because he's voted consistently for the people who implement these policies. When he voted against Donald Trump, he voted against peace, he voted for war, and he got what he voted for. How did we know that? Out of the last six presidents, the only one that didn't destroy a country was Donald Trump. The only one that brought more peace, not more war, was Donald Trump. And here we are, 18 months later, and now, many, you know, 3 years later, looking at thermonuclear war, war in the Middle East again, just, you know, Spain's on fire. What is going on?
Okay, right? Well, we're up against the break. So I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to give Senator Mastriano a chance to close out and
sure, and
close out before we take our 1 o'clock break. Senator, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you both for having me on. And, you know, there's a lot of struggles that we have in the party. You know, the base is growing, so the base, we need to stay engaged. I'm concerned that in some circles that we're, you know, carry on with our pre-COVID chaotic and busy lives and now no longer being engaged politically. That's a dangerous trend because that's really what largely got us here, was apathy, right, and being too scared. So I'm admonishing and encouraging people to stay engaged. You don't have to be as, you know, engaged as you were last year, but we still need you to attend events and, you know, be active on social media and, you know, and be active locally, especially where we did have some great victories across the state. I'm heartbroken what happened in Philadelphia. That means it's going to go from bad to worse in the city, and that just breaks my heart. It's such a beautiful city, should be the shiny gem on the Delaware.
Well, I hate to cut you off, Doug, but we have to run. But we're gonna definitely continue this conversation next week because we got a lot of work to do. You're listening to the Conservative Voice here on WWDB 8:68 a.m. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this short break.
I'm brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
Discover spirituality for everyday living.